Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here at Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are deep in Hydra territory with lots of stuff going on. But Hal, let's pick up where we are here in minute 61.
Minute 61. In the cavernous Hydra factory, Steve Rogers moves with silent precision between rows of futuristic weapons, their eerie blue glow casting shadows. Spotting a small pulsating device on a metal workbench, he swiftly pockets it, the unearthly light dimming as it disappears into his gear. Ascending to the second level of the prison block, Steve ambushes a Hydra guard, knocking him out with a single blow. Peering down into the dimly lit cells, he sees the haggard faces of the 107th prisoners staring back. Gabe, a prisoner with a skeptical squint, calls out, "Who are you supposed to be?" Steve, gripping the guard's keys, replies firmly, "I'm Captain America." Pinky, a British prisoner, blinks in disbelief. "I beg your pardon?" Steve unlocks the cell door, swinging it open to free the men. As they shuffle out, Dum Dum Dugan notices a Japanese soldier emerging from an adjacent cell. He raises an eyebrow, muttering, "What are we taking, everybody?"
And we lose the punchline in the next minute.
Right, so. Exactly.
Oh, well.
It's a cliffhanger. Wait for the punchline. Not to spoil tomorrow or our next episode, but that is, I love that line that's coming next. So anyway,
before we get going, gents, I wanted to give a shout out to a listener. I got a private message from a listener named Mick, and Mick listened to our recent episode about fondue and fondueing, and sent me a message that says, "After listening to the latest episode, I made fondue last night, which we ate while watching Captain America: The First Avenger." And then he signs off, "Fondue nerds."
Fondue nerds.
So I don't know if he's calling us the fondue nerds or if we collectively, including Mick, are fondue nerds. But thanks so much for that, Mick. Yes. It's nice to know you're out there listening to us and enjoying the fondue.
Yeah.
I feel like Mick deserves the benefit of the doubt. And like, until he comes forward and says, "Yes, I included myself," we'll just take the burden. We'll be the three fondue nerds. But who knew when we started this thing that we'd influence a meal.
Wow.
Yeah. I think that's our legacy. That's the lasting legacy.
Every time you see a fondue pot, you'll think of us.
We're here in minute 61. Do we just call it good?
You know,
minute 61, yada, 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 closing credits directed by Joe Johnston. Good night, everybody.
Wow. I just keep wondering, how did they miss that as a marketing campaign? They could have, you know, like in those dine-in, watching a movie places, that you could just have fondue pots set up at everybody's table or
red,
chair.
White, and fawn blue.
Yeah. Ooh.
Ooh. Ooh, blue cheese. There we go.
I smell a tagline.
They, of course, could have held the premiere in Fond du Lac, as we were discussing in the green room the other day, just down the road.
I thought we told you in the green room to never bring that up again, Hal, but thank you.
You groaned, and producer in chief O'Kane over there said, "Hey, that sounds perfect. Get him on the show." Invite the entire city if you have to.
Oh, man. So this is a fun minute of the movie. It continues the sort of slapstickiness of the previous 2 minutes. And I was particularly impressed with this minute, how much work sound does here, how much of the violence is off screen and implied. You know, when Steve knocks out that first Hydra goon, we don't see Steve at all. He's a wraith. He's Batman. He's in the shadows. And all we see is the guy fall down and onto the grate. And sound, I think, is one of the great overlooked elements of filmmaking that Joe Johnston is using to great effect here.
Yeah, I mean, the cavernous, you feel it. I mean, when we see he's pocketing that blue little, I don't know what you call it. It's like a double A battery of
a gizmo, I believe is the technical term.
Oh, magic. A battery full of magic.
Yes, a little double A tesseract that you can fit in your pocket. But just when he picks it up, there's that little woo sound coming out of it as he's putting it in. So it's, you just keep going shh, as you're looking at the thing. I do like the meta, we were talking about this the other day about the Stan Lee era, that 65 era of metonymic writing that Steve knows Captain America is a silly name, but it doesn't hit him until he's saying, "Oh, I'm Captain America." So, and to his ear, it's something that he's heard all the time, every night in Buffalo and Scranton, that people call him
punching Captain Hitler America. 200 times. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Spoiler alert for the next minute. Yeah, I'm sorry. But...
we'll get there.
We'll get there. Yeah. Well,
and I thought that scene. So number one, it's great. We're getting. We're seeing him uniting with the Howling Commandos and hearing from a couple more of the commandos. But there, for me, there's a whole, I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm here to rescue you.
Yes. Yes.
There, who are you supposed to be? I'm Captain America. It's like, beg your pardon? Like what is that even supposed to mean? And as you were saying, Jim, he's so used to saying it now, he realizes it sounds silly. But it sounds even sillier when they have no idea what you're even talking about or referring to.
Like, he's the guy with the keys, and they're happy to see him.
Yes, exactly. But he's got the keys.
I love that I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm here to rescue you, Hal. I think it's beautiful. And it also is reminding me a little bit of the scene in the first Avengers movie when Captain America lands on the roof of the police car and he starts barking out orders to the cops. And one cop says, "Why should I listen to you?" And then Cap KOs one of the invaders with a shield, and the cop immediately starts barking out, repeating Steve's orders. Right. There's something about Steve Rogers, even an inexperienced, totally green Steve Rogers that we know him to be in this minute of the movie, who commands respect and authority. These men, they'll follow him. They'll when he tells them it's 80 yards to the tree line, they'll believe him.
And this is the first time that he is actually giving orders. And it's funny that Gabe says it rather presciently. Who are you supposed to be? And this is, since the beginning of the movie, this is who Steve Rogers is supposed to be. He's supposed to be Captain America.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought about that, sort of that double entendre there of sorts. And, Brian, you're talking about, bookending this with that scene in the first Avengers movie. Hey, those are just great you could use those as lessons in leadership, in that, 80-90% of it is, showing up and showing up with confidence and having an idea and just being an example and, the right person in the right place, and people will follow.
I think in law enforcement, it's known as officer presence, that you are.
Oh, yes.
If you show yourself as being, I'm the guy in charge here. This is the, I am your authority, and you got to talk not to your cerebellum, but to your amygdala, that there's somebody that's in charge, and that's who, that's who you're talking to. That you're the person in charge. So you use your dad voice, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. In my law enforcement days, we used the term officer presence. There was a command presence, a command authority, and then there was a when we talked about the continuum of force and, escalations of force and things like that. One of the first things is that command voice, and, that's sort of step one in that process of, I'm telling you to do this and you need to do it. Otherwise there's other tools further down the list in the toolbox that we have to get to.
Yeah. I think we underestimate the amount of study there is in command. That, I mean, the Army has OCS, they have, Officer Candidate School, where you learn how to be in charge of things. But Steve never went through that. He just picked it up kind of on his own, as this is how I was talked to, and this is how you deliver orders. And he's known the appropriate way of doing it, but this is the first time he's actually putting it into action.
Right. He does seem confident at this point, early in his career, in his physical abilities. He knows he can, jump a 20-foot wall and leap tall buildings, leap small buildings in single bounds, and so forth. He knows he's strong, so he knows he's got the tools. But I'm kind of along the same lines, surprised he at this point in his career really knows how to wield them, how to turn them to authority, and I'm going to lead these men into battle, because he's never been in battle yet.
Yeah, I mean, his fight with Kruger back in the Brooklyn docks was, he really wasn't in charge. He was apologizing the whole time he was fighting Kruger. So, worrying about bystanders and passersby. And I think that might've been, Brian, would you say that his kryptonite is just his compassion for others along the way? Like, basically, if you're threatening other people, he has to figure out what to do to get around people that he cares about being threatened.
I think so. I mean, I think that's certainly more true for Superman, who is truly invulnerable and you know, strong enough to move planets. I mean, Steve can be beaten up. He can be overpowered. He's not Superman. He's as good as a human can be, but an appropriate metahuman, someone who's, you know, like a Thanos could handle him pretty easily, or a Hulk could really handle him. Actually, I'd say pretty easily, but I think Steve versus the Hulk would be an interesting fight. But yeah, basically, you're right. With all these characters who were more or less purely good, and I just keep coming back to Superman as a DC analog of it, their weakness is the people they care about and the things they care about, and harming innocents and, you know, and protecting innocents. They will take a bullet to protect an innocent. And in Steve's case, he's not superhuman. A bullet could kill Steve Rogers.
Yeah, and that whole idea of the people that he cares about as the weak point. Superman always had Jimmy Olsen and Lois to worry about, and I think even Batman. Was it the Joker that called Robin the boy hostage? That it was.
Yes.
Well, it pays not to examine these things too closely, too. I mean, no superhero has any business taking a 12-year-old boy and putting him in green tights and, you know, shoving him into harm's way. We can't. And people have. Comic book creators have done that. And I think it's always a misfire and the wrong thing to do that leads to some really terrible things. But at the level of this movie, I think what we're seeing Steve do is just right. You know, and again, it's. I kind of circle back. This isn't purely rated, but the cartooniness of this violence is going to contrast with more realistic violence in the coming minutes when we see people getting shot and people dying and people getting vaporized by Hydra blue beams. We're having fun now, but stuff's about to get real.
Yeah.
And I think Joe Johnston is kind of ramping us up to that. He's kind of ramping up the action, ramping up the violence. And we're going to get there soon in about a minute and a half, 2 minutes of people dying.
Yeah, and it's—I mean—the tendency is nerfing the violence levels in movies that you're not, you know, it's like the G.I. Joe cartoons where everybody that gets shot in a plane, that you, the next thing you see is a parachute. Don't worry, they didn't get hurt. They're all okay. But this, you know, there is some real casualties coming up.
Yep. And that's that's what's going to make the, as you said, Brian, it's going to make it real, and that's what's going to make the stakes so high. You know, circling back just for a second, I had another thought about, you know, where Steve is at this point with his leadership and things. It's not a direct analog. It's not the direct way to prepare for truly going into combat, but realizing, you know, as we'll discuss in our next episode, you know, what he's done at least 200 times, all that time going from city to city and just those performances on stage, it seems like a bit of a stretch, but you talk about a confidence builder. And if you're just talking about building up somebody's regular confidence, he's going everywhere he goes. He's got people cheering for him. He's got a whole line of chorus girls, you know, dressed like him and singing his name and everything. And he knows his lines, and the kids are cheering and screaming. And I'm not saying at all that it's an ego thing, but in terms of, you know, where skinny Steve was versus where, you know, bulked up Steve is, confidence is not going to be, you know, his weak point at this point.
I see where you're going with that. And I really like it, because there's that whole montage of the USO show where Steve comes out in his very first show. He's very uncertain. He's reading the cards off the back of his shield.
Right.
And, you know, 200 shows later, he's freaking Captain America, and he's lifting that motorcycle up, and there's thousands of people cheering for him. And yeah, I'm with you on that, because I think a fair amount of confidence and leadership is faking it till you make it.
Right.
And Steve's been faking it pretty well. He's getting better and better at faking it. And now he's in
faking
the real
it all
deal.
Over the country.
Yeah.
How long would you say that it was between the time that he started the USO show till he was in Italy? How 200 shows, you know, is he doing three a day, two a day?
See, I think he's traveling too much. I think there's too many cities. I mean, unless he's doing, you know, two shows at a city, which is not impossible. But even if you said, you know, okay, if he's doing, say he did 100 cities, he did a matinee and an evening show, and he's doing, I mean, even if, is that
so like three, a four, four, four months?
Three a week, four, maybe
five
one
months,
city,
maybe.
One city a week. So four cities a month. I mean, you could get to, you could get to several months, or you could get to maybe not pushing a year.
Yeah. But when I'm watching the movie, it feels like a few months to me. I mean, I never did the math, and the math is daunting if we take Steve's 200 as not hyperbole, but it feels like a few months. I mean, if he's too long, the war's over.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
but think about it, let's say he did four shows a week, whether that was two in this city and two in the next city or something. I mean, that's a year or 50 weeks anyway, to get to 200. But again, as you say, assuming that's not hyperbole, but I don't think Steve's much of a self-aggrandizing exaggerator.
Oh, he's an honest fella.
Yeah. I think he's probably got a clicker in his pocket. He knows exactly how many times.
He's got that. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, from what we saw in the movie, he's out on a summer day or a springtime day in Brooklyn when he first has to face the thug in the alleyway. And then he goes to the World's Fair or the World's Exposition or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I get the feeling that's like spring or summer, early, maybe May. And then when we see him in Italy, I believe the caption is either October or November of 1943. I think it was October of 1943.
Okay.
That we see him. So yeah, I guess it's most of the summer and part of the fall.
Right. Could be an easy 5-6 months of that.
And don't forget, he was in, like, he had been going to Hollywood to stand in front of the rear projection to do all those scenes with the other actors. So
true. He was doing the newsreels too.
Yeah. So, and I'm assuming that on all of these things, he's on military transport. So he's probably around a lot of soldiers, sailors, airmen so he's picking up the flow of military life.
I figure he was just doing basically the Bob Hope show, you know, in Vietnam era. He was going to, you know, a couple of, and we see the disastrous impression he leaves on soldiers who've been in combat, but he's entertaining the troops. He's entertaining the folks. He's doing what he can to support the war. They're using him like Bob Hope. Listeners want to Google Bob Hope,
the Hollywood canteen type of thing. It's soldiers stateside.
Yeah. But
now putting him out in the ETO, it's a different story.
Yeah.
Brian, what are the chances we can get you to do a graphic novel about Bob Hope with super soldier serum?
Oh, I love it. You know, there was a Bob Hope comic book, and I don't think Bob had anything to do with it. But but the Bob Hope comic book was done by, I think, DC. And so we'd have to get rights. We'd have to get permission from two rival companies, I think. Or Bob Hope's estate. Boy, you know, I just don't think I can do that, Hal.
They were so close, though. Yeah, it's a heavy lift. So close.
Bob Hope with Hal?
I do not.
I got to tell you.
Certainly, grew up very aware of him and stuff. I think, I don't know how many generations after mine and ours would be.
None. But I want to talk about Bob Hope for a second anyway, just to say that by the time I was aware of Bob Hope, he was, at least in my mind, and I think it's a general reputation, an old, over-the-hill, unfunny comedian who came out and did his one-liners and occasionally hosted the Academy Awards. He was old and out of date and obsolete.
Right.
But you go back and you watch those Bob Hope, Bing Crosby movies.
The Road movies?
Oh, my God. The Road movies are wonderful. And it's like, I watched those probably in high school. And I was like, what a revelation. Oh, this guy was funny. These movies are fantastic.
And he's going 1,000 miles an hour quick. And the two of them together were so, so good. And like you said, by the time we're seeing him, you know, maybe doing Vietnam era stuff or then after that, and he's just getting older, it's like, oh, look, it's a legend. Say something legendary. Okay, thanks. Now, go back to Palm Springs.
I remember 50 years ago, as we're recording this, he had done a bicentennial album. He said, "America Still Has Hope" was the name of the album.
Oh, jeez.
And something that was pointed out in the liner notes is he could never run for president because he was born in London.
Oh, so interesting.
Yeah.
There you go.
And that's all I know about Bob Hope. Yeah. A friend of mine, Julie, was she was in the same film school that I was at the University of Texas, and Bob Hope was making a presentation at the University of Texas. And she was one of the people kind of leading Bob around, getting him back and forth to the hotel. And he was, I think, late 80s. He was, you know, late 80s or early 90s when she was dealing with him. And he said to her, you know, what are you planning on doing with your degree? And she says, well, I'm trying to work behind the scenes on films. And he actually hooked her up with an agent that worked for, I think it was Universal, and got
Wow.
her in to get on like internships and job work were out in
Wow.
Hollywood. So Julie owes
Indeed.
her career in out in Hollywood to Bob Hope of all
Oh.
people, you know, just one phone call away from success.
That's fantastic.
As far as I can tell, without thinking about it any harder than I'd care to, I think I'm one degree of separation from Bob Hope because I met Bing Crosby when I was a little kid.
Wow.
Because he lived right there,
Nice.
Brian, you know where this is. He lived right in Burlingame.
Yep.
And I remember my dad and I walking downtown. I might have been maybe 5 years old. And this guy's walking the other way up the street, and he's, you know, in his kind of khaki everything, and he's got his fishing hat on with the flies and things in
Did he have a putter over his shoulder? Was he
it. You'd
smoking a
think he
pipe?
would have smoking his pipe. He was yelling at his kids. It was everything was perfect. And my dad kind of made a point to, you know, very politely say, well, you know, hello, you know, good evening. It's very, very nice to see you. And that's wasn't very typical of dad to be super chatty. And so, and then he told me, say hello. So I said, hello. And then we kept walking. And I said, who was that? And he says, it was Bing Crosby. And I wasn't really sure who that was. I said, well, you know, who's he exactly? And he said, well, he's really into fishing. It's like that's how my dad explained who this was because of the hat and things. And I think, okay, well, that's cool. I mean, everybody needs a hobby. That's great. But I'm not sure why it was sort of this big deal to say hi to this fisherman. So, anyway,
That's
So now
wonderful.
every time you put on White Christmas, all you can think of is trout.
Yeah,
Yeah, well,
exactly.
that makes us 2 degrees, Jim. Look at us.
Yes,
So,
we're now part of the crew.
yeah.
Wow. Well, these are exciting times. I'm not exactly sure what
So
else
you
to say
say.
about this minute, but it's...
Well, this is the beauty of it. We didn't start this minute knowing we'd be talking about Bob Hope, but there you go.
Right.
Yeah, it's
You never know where the train's going to leave.
Well, I'm going to go have a glass of Minute Maid orange juice, and
Yes.
that won't apply to anybody under 50, I think.
I'm going to go swing on a star,
Yes.
carry moonbeams home in a jar, et
Yeah.
cetera.
Wow. Well, Brian, you have a very white Christmas, and
Rum, rum, pa pa pum pum.
bo 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 bo. See, the
Boom,
only,
boom,
yep, I mean,
boom,
most of what I know about Bing Crosby comes to me through Tex Avery, so I don't, you know, it's
boom.
not going.
Yes.
It's probably a little bit clouded, but yeah, anyway, this has been a great minute. We've got more minutes coming up. Good. So please stay with us. It really, we'll try and be. There's a thing that I think it was. I think we had Mark, my old co-host Mark Cerulli was on the Rocketeer Minute, and he was talking about Alan Arkin. Alan Arkin was at a show, and as he was going up, someone leaned over to Alan and said, "Don't forget to be interesting." So I think I'll take the words that were given to Alan Arkin. We'll try not to forget to be interesting.
Mick, I want to hear from you. Did we
Yes.
do it?
Yes, please, Mick.
Jim, we're only 61 episodes in. It's not too late just to start over
I know.
and be interesting. I
We
mean,
got to work on
we
it.
can give it a
Take
go.
better notes. That's what we got to do. Okay, more prep time. But anyway, thank you for putting up with us. If you would like to continue this conversation for who knows why, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, please do. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.